Donald Trump's lawyers have concluded their first day of opening arguments in his Senate impeachment trial, insisting that Democrats are trying to overturn the results of the 2016 election and that the investigations of Mr. Trump's dealings with Ukraine have not been a fact-finding mission but a politically motivated effort to force him out of the White House. Trump lawyer Pat Cipollone said the Democrats wanted, quote, to perpetrate the most massive interference in an election in American history, and he said, we can't allow that to happen. Cipollone and the rest of the Trump team will resume their case on Monday. Health authorities in the United States are closely watching for new signs of the deadly coronavirus. In China, the death toll stands at 41, with nearly 1,300 confirmed cases spread across 29 provinces and cities. 15 medical workers have been sickened. One Chinese doctor has died. Two cases of the infection have been identified here in the U.S. Meanwhile, in the Chinese city of Wuhan, where it's believed the new virus was born, authorities have tightened emergency rules to deal with the crisis. The AP's Charles Ledesma has the story.
The virus-hit city of Wuhan, already on lockdown, will ban most vehicles, including private cars, from the downtown area in a further bid to limit the spread of a new disease that has infected more than 1,000 people and killed dozens. State media says only vehicles authorized to carry supplies and other key needs would be permitted after midnight Saturday. The transportation bans have been expanded to 16 cities, holding a population of more than 50 million people hostage to the disease. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In Turkey, emergency officials today said the death toll from yesterday's earthquake that rocked eastern Turkey has climbed to 21, with more than 1,000 people injured. Rescue workers continue searching for dozens of victims believed to be buried under the rubble of collapsed buildings in below-freezing temperatures. More news at voanews.com online. There is also a mobile app. From Washington, this is VOA News. The Pentagon has revised upward the number of U.S. troops injured in Iran's missile attacks on two Iraqi military bases earlier this month. Initially reporting no injuries, that was later adjusted by the Pentagon to 11. The figure now is tripled to 34. Here's the AP's Ben Thomas.
I heard that they had headaches.
That was President Trump earlier this week. Shortly after the January 8th strike, he said he'd been told there were no U.S. troops injured. But the Pentagon now says 34 service members have been diagnosed with concussions and 17 remain under medical observation or treatment.
A lot of these symptoms, they are late developing. They manifest over a period of time.
Spokesman Jonathan Hoffman explained.
The symptoms can get better, they can get worse. So we may see those numbers change a little bit. This is a snapshot in time.
Asked Wednesday whether he considered traumatic brain injuries serious, President Trump said,
no, I don't consider them very serious injuries relative to other injuries that I've seen.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
Australia marks its National Day tomorrow. It is an annual day of celebration, but there is something else as well. Phil Mercer reports for VOA from Sydney.
To many Indigenous people, January 26, 1788, was the day when their land was taken by the British, led by Captain Arthur Phillip. He was the commander of the first fleet of 11 British ships, which arrived at Sydney Cove to signal the birth of the colony. Across the country, Australia Day harbours so many emotions, anger, sadness, pride and celebration. There'll be so-called Invasion Day rallies, as well as festivities and parties. The government body that organises various community events, the Australia Day Council, said the highs and lows of history are commemorated.
That was Phil Mercer for VOA from Sydney, Australia. Indonesia's top security official says a detained U.S. journalist should be deported without delay. 30-year-old Philip Jacobson, a reporter for a California-based environmental news outlet, was taken into custody last month in Borneo after attending a regional parliamentary hearing involving the People's Alliance of the Archipelago, the country's largest indigenous rights group. This week, Jacobson was formally arrested and was told he faced up to 5 years in prison for entering Indonesia with the wrong visa, a claim his employer and U.S. officials have disputed. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is accusing the Libyan militia leader, General Khalifa Haftar, of violating a ceasefire agreement. But despite deploying Turkish forces to back the Libyan government of national accord, observers suggest Erdogan seems to be increasingly looking to diplomacy rather than force. Haftar's forces control most of Libya in its war against the United Nations-recognized government in Tripoli. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
It's been conferences and recommendations made, and some of these, which we had even brought to Parliament when I last sat there, were shut down by those who didn't want these reforms. We are and have been for reform all the time.
Malawian main opposition leader calls for calm as judges are ready to rule over the outcome of the presidential election case.
I think much things are going to happen in the next time. And the Isabel issue is the beginning of a more complex process of fighting corruption in Angola.
The Angolan main opposition party, UNITA, calls for independent and thorough investigations into allegations of public corruption.
Any country that does not take access to quality education as a right, certainly to that extent, has failed itself, it has also failed others, because we do need everybody's support to have education.
And the President of the United Nations General Assembly leads a high-level interactive dialogue to promote quality education. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The presidential candidate for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, is calling on supporters of the group not to lose hope ahead of the anticipated ruling by judges over the challenge of the outcome of the presidential election. Lazarus Chakwera says there is need for supporters and opponents to have faith in the court to ensure justice. His comments come as a panel of five judges is expected soon to issue judgment about the challenge of the result of the presidential vote. To learn more about his call on Malawians to have faith in the effort to seek justice, I reached Lazarus Chakwera, presidential candidate for the main opposition party, MCP, in the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
I'm basically encouraging everybody and giving hope that we shouldn't lose heart just because it's been a long wait and a long trial now that we're about to receive the court's judgment. And I call on the people to respect the judiciary and what they determine.
Some people are expressing concern that there could be violence if the decision goes against you or perhaps against the opposition candidate. How did you address this concern?
I am just addressing people that we are seeking justice and the courts are for justice. I'm sure they will order us according to how they have determined the case, and they should be very thorough. And what they will have determined will make sense because we'll be just.
President Mutharika has made several calls to the opposition for dialogue, for peace, to ease the political tension in the country. As a prominent opposition leader, what are your thoughts about his call?
He hasn't made any of such calls to us and people that have been mediating. I'm out publicly talking to those people that we are ready to talk. When the judgment has been declared, all I understand is that sometimes when he is coming back from a meeting or he is going out, like he went out to the UK, he made a comment before he boarded the plane and said he wants to talk. He hasn't talked to us.
Public Affairs Committee, a quasi-religious group, is seeking to mediate to ease political tension. What do you make of the gesture?
We have always welcomed their gesture. I have met with them twice, and that's what I made reference to when I publicly told the country that I'm willing to meet with any Malawian who is concerned about the future of our country.
Supporters of the MCP, the biggest opposition party in Malawi, expressed concern, citing voter irregularities as one of the things that led to the skewed result of the presidential election. You participated in it. You saw what happened. How confident are you that your challenge will be successful?
That is for the courts to determine. We have presented our case before the courts, and we presented what we think is a great case. And so I can't go into details as to what they might or might not do, whether they file testimony or not. That will be their prerogative.
So what do you think are the best steps forward to resolve what a lot of Malawians have said is a growing political tension in the country?
I have stated today that the judgment will form a foundation for talks and reconciliation in the nation, because we, apart from the legal battle, we will need to find a political solution to move ahead. And that is why we must respect the court determines and then find a way forward from there.
What are your thoughts about complete electoral reforms, as some of your compatriots in Malawi are demanding?
That is something that has always been there. After each election, there's always been conferences and recommendations made. And some of these, which we had even brought to Parliament when I last sat there, were shut down by those who didn't want these reforms. We are and have been for reform all the time.
Lazarus Chakwera is the presidential candidate for the Malawi Congress Party, MCP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Isabel dos Santos, Africa's richest woman and daughter of former Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos, says she plans to sue the government in Luanda. This after denying accusations of corruption, saying the accusations by the Angolan Attorney General are politically motivated. Local media quote Attorney General Helder Peter Gross as saying Ms. dos Santos will be charged with forgery of documents, money laundering, influence peddling, harmful management and other economic crimes. Alcide Sakala, an opposition member of the Angolan Parliament and the spokesperson for the main opposition party, UNITA, tells me his group welcomes accountability, thorough and independent inquiry into all acts of public corruption.
For UNITA, it is not a surprise what is happening to Isabel dos Santos and dos Santos family in general. It was something expected. And fortunately, Angola has not yet the separation of powers. So as you may understand, the powers were concentrated on the hands of the dos Santos family, and that is the consequences. I'm sure that the Angola judiciary system has all the means, the capabilities of moving ahead with this process, reading the statements that they have done in the previous 24 hours. I'm sure that a process is underway so that measures can be taken as far as the fighting against corruption is concerned.
But what do you say to those supporters of Dos Santos's family who say that this whole thing about the fight against corruption is targeting the Dos Santos family?
Yes, there is this perception in the country that Jean Lorenzo is targeting all of the Dos Santos family. But the most important is that UNITA has been denouncing long time ago the corruption in this country, the money that has been stolen by dos Santos government people during so many years, especially after the war. We are not in government, as you know. We don't have the tools to fight corruptions, but we have the capacity of denouncing. That's why Mr. Lorenzo should be encouraged to continue with the fight of corruption. Much more has to be done. Instead of being selective, that's the perception that one may get. I think the government should push ahead with the targeting others that are well known in our society. We are conscious that that is a process that will take time, while we are pressuring for the need of the separation of the institutions of powers in the country, so that the judiciary may have more independence in dealing with these particular issues.
So is UNITA pleased with the fight against corruption that the president and his administration have launched so far?
We do not have any official communication on that. All that we know about all those guys who have been stealing the money is through our own channels. The point is that if the request of UNITA on auditing the Angolan debt, for instance, the Son Angola counters were accepted, that could have helped to better understand the extent of this process. So by refusing that, the perception that we have is that there is a very tough struggle between those who are supporting Dos Santos and others who are supporting João Lourenço. And I think much things are going to happen in the next time. And the Isabel issue is the beginning of a more complex process of fighting corruption in Angola.
Alcide Sakala is an opposition member of the Angolan Parliament and the spokesperson for the main opposition party, UNITA. He spoke with me from the capital, Luanda. The president of the United Nations General Assembly led a high-level interactive dialogue to coincide with the International Day of Education at the UN headquarters in New York Friday. The high-level dialogue sought to promote a common understanding of inclusive education and lifelong learning. It also looked for ways to strengthen quality education for all. For more on the meeting, including how the respective countries seek to resolve challenges in ensuring quality education for all students, including those in areas of conflict, I reached Nigerian Ambassador Tijani Mohammed Bandi, who is also the president of the UN General Assembly. So, Mr. President, how do they cooperate with the UN in surmounting some of the challenges you have clearly outlined?
I think that, first of all, to talk of data, they have to know their own problems. Without knowing their own problems, they are unable to get the assistance or attention they are able to receive in the system. They also must listen, because the United Nations as a body provides a platform for people to share ideas and information. This is extremely important in all facets of life, especially in relation to education.
A lot of these African countries committed themselves to actualizing the Sustainable Development Goals. With regards to focusing on education, how do they work with the UN in order to see a realization of quality education with the view of reaching the level of the Sustainable Development Goals commitment they made?
I think all countries in the world, not only Africa, have committed to the goals. And of course, in terms of how well they are on target, I think broadly what we can say is that there is a variance between countries in relation to how much or how well they are on target. Now, there is a process of what is called voluntary national reviews. Countries will decide when they are able to come and voluntarily show on various targets how well they are doing and how not well they are doing and why. Through that kind of approach, they hear what others are doing, and they also are able to get support from not only UN but other agencies. There are private sector or companies that are able to give support if they are requested directly in terms of things that are practical. So the process of voluntary national reviews connects not only to what has been done in education, but in all areas of the goals, 17 of them. Education is but one, important as it is.
After Friday's event, what will be your expectations in terms of aligning inclusive quality education with sustainable development goals?
I think Our issue is simply we use that as a platform to remind and to urge and to also see what partnerships can be either created or deepened to share information, to share ideas, and even at times to share resources, maybe even sharing resources in terms of exchange of teachers, exchange of students, and other mechanisms. Now, this was to be understood not only in terms of what countries work with the United Nations, but also how through reflections about their, each country reflecting about its own issues relating to quality education access to, how they are also able to work with sub-regional and regional bodies to also hasten the process to guarantee 100% education, not only for boys and girls, but for all, including the disabled, because education in relation to disability is also an issue. You do need people with skills to take on board how to give instruction to people with different kinds of disability. Now, special education is therefore also important, and this is an area in which many countries are deficient in terms of having qualified teachers to tackle the needs of those who require further assistance.
What is the message to the world, and particularly in Africa, about ensuring quality education for the majority or people who cannot have access to?
I think the message is this, that any country that does not take access to quality education as a right, certainly to that extent, has failed itself. It has also failed others, because we do need everybody's support to have education to make it easier and better for the persons, for individuals to contribute to the effort to develop the continent. Education is such a key. Education is also important in one very important aspect, because it's also an equalizer. It is one thing that ensures that people can overcome their social class. When you have an education, you can do far more than you ordinarily would have done. And it is one way to guarantee the equalizing element in terms of rights and inclusion of others in the social development process.
Nigerian Ambassador Tijani Mohammed Bande is president of the UN General Assembly. He spoke with me from New York. The Horn of Africa has been hit by the worst invasion of locusts in 25 years. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization said Friday that the invasion poses an unprecedented threat to food security in the entire sub-region, where over 19 million people in East Africa are already experiencing a high degree of food insecurity. Invasions of locusts are irregular in the region. In Kenya, it is the worst invasion in 70 years. For more, my colleague Douglas Impuga reached Fred Omulu, a Kenyan journalist in Kisumu.
The general situation is that, first of all, there's an unprecedented locust invasion in Kenya. We've never seen this kind of thing before. And so far, I think it's affecting almost 16 counties, mostly in the eastern and the northeastern part of the country. And they are moving deeper and deeper into the country. I think they've already started reaching the central areas. A place called Laikipia has been spotted. And they seem to be attacking mostly wild vegetation. So far, I haven't seen major complaints or losses in terms of crops that farmers have been growing around.
But there is indeed a real fear that these locusts may destroy some crops in some areas.
Yes, they are moving. They are moving deeper and deeper into Kenya, into rich agricultural land. So, for example, in eastern, they've reached a place called Meru, which is part of the breadbaskets of Kenya, considering areas like Central Province are neighboring there. So I think it's only a matter of time before it becomes a national disaster. But it is it's a growing problem. It's been there for the last 3 to 4 weeks.
We have reports of some rudimentary measures to fend off these locusts, making tin noise. Some people are firing in the air. Is there any way that government is trying to help to stop the locust movement?
So far, they haven't proposed anything that I can consider scientific or even effective, right? There are all sorts of various ways that can be used, including overhead sprays from aircraft. We haven't seen any of that being done. The rudimentary measures are very limited considering the depth and the width of that menace. So I can't really say that the government is doing anything serious. We've had a lot of statements, though, at least once every week for the last 3 weeks. You've seen them talking about it. But they haven't really come up with any serious measure that you can say has had an impact on the spread.
And the desert locust number in millions.
Millions and millions. Apparently, they crossed over. There was a serious climate change event towards the end of 2019, which stimulated their reproduction in Yemen. And these are desert locusts. So Yemen is just across from Somalia. Somalia is actually having the same problem as us, and Somalia neighbors us. So they've just been moving across the Indian Ocean, all of it into Africa. And there's fears that they might come closer to the central and the western regions of the country in the next few weeks.
Fred Omolo is a Kenyan journalist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpoga from Kisumu. The Atlanta-based Carter Center released its latest report on the implementation of the 2015 Mali Peace Agreement this week. The report expresses concern that poor leadership, distrust among the parties, and the deficit in the international community's mediation efforts contributed to the lack of progress in the implementation of the peace accord. The report also urges vigorous measures to consolidate peace in Mali. The Carter Center serves as the independent observer of Mali's 2015 peace agreement implementation. For more about the report, I reach the Carter Center's special advisor on Mali, Ambassador Bissa Williams.
The message of the report is that the year 2019 saw almost no progress in implementation of the report. So it's a terrible missed opportunity. The report really is sounding an alarm that there has been too little political will, too little leadership over this process. And all of the Malian parties involved, that means the government and the former rebels and civil society, need to really bear down and make some progress. The report also faults the international community because the international community seemed to withdraw its engagement with the parties. And this is a process. The situation in Mali is such that it must have sustained, energetic support from all of the international parties.
Were there no commitments from both sides? And with regards to the international community, whatever happened to ECOWAS in its stability measure or policy to ensure regional stability in this West African sub-region?
The international partners have made tremendous commitments. MINUSMA is an extremely robust UN engagement. Expensive, but it's more expensive than blood and treasure. Internationals have given their lives to help protect, to help save the peace in Mali. We are not faulting that part of the engagement of the international community. The ECOWAS states, especially with the support of the G5 Sahel, have made their commitment, and the ECOWAS states have made even a greater monetary commitment to support the G5. That is an important aspect of the security question, particularly as the crisis in Central Mali has taken a lot more energy and taken a lot of people's attention. The crisis has gotten worse. But we're talking about the kind of not only moral but supportive persuasion and pressure that some of the states need to bring to bear in this process to help convince the parties to make their important compromises, to make decisions about moving forward. The peace agreement was very explicit in the kinds of improvements that were needed, the steps that were needed to solidify a peace in Mali. The implementation of the peace accord ought to be an exercise in how to affect these steps. And the international community, including the mediation, which are the formal guarantors of the agreement, has got to continue to use its powers of persuasion to get the parties to work together and to take tough decisions.
Did the parties outline some of the challenges they faced in the full implementation of the 2015 peace accord?
Our report outlines some of those challenges. Yes, they do. But the challenges are not bigger than the people who are supposed to handle them, is what I want to say. Now, I will say our report covers generally what happened in 2019, which I said was a very difficult and disappointing year. However, at the very end of 2019, a couple of important things happened, one of which, the most important of which, was that the government held what is called the National Inclusive Dialogue. And that was the very first time in our 2 years of watching the implementation of this treaty that the government created a forum where everybody could come and express their views about
the situation in Mali, including about the implementation of the peace agreement. So in the same room, you had the movements, the representatives of the rebel movements, you had the government, you had civil society members. Unfortunately, you did not have the official political opposition, but you had plenty of people, regular people, civil society, who opposed the agreement because basically because they didn't understand it and they feared that the agreement was going to put them at a disadvantage. The good thing about that, I think that was an important positive development because what the people realized as they heard each other, as the northerners heard the southerners and the southerners listened to the northerners, the eastern, they realized that they were all in agreement that the peace accord that they have is the one they want to work with. The peace accord that they have, even if they want to make certain changes to it, the changes can be made with the provisions that there are articles in the accord that provide for how to make amendments. And all sides said, well, okay, if we agree that that's how we're going to do it, now we can move forward.
Ambassador Bissa Williams is the Carter Center Special Advisor on Mali. She spoke with me from the Malian capital, Bamako. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of the Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the UN Refugee Agency and partners are appealing for $658 million this year for 735,000 refugees and more than half a million Ethiopians hosting them. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency praises the many rights granted by the Ethiopian government to refugees during the last 3 years. They include granting refugees the right to work and access social services, primary education, registered births, and other essential benefits. But UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic says resources are needed to expand existing social services and finance a number of other basic needs.
The Ethiopia Refugee Response Plan covers humanitarian activities by UNHCR and 57 other humanitarian partners. It seeks to address huge gaps in health, nutrition, education, and shelter, while also investing in sectors including sanitation, energy, and livelihoods.
Ethiopia has a long history of hosting refugees and asylum seekers. Mahecic tells VOA the country currently is hosting nearly 750,000 refugees of 26 nationalities. The majority, he says, is from South Sudan, followed by Somalia, Eritrea, and Sudan.
There is no massive influx right now, but the number of refugees is expected to grow substantially during the course of the year as the country continues to receive refugees, with nearly about 100,000 new arrivals that came in 2019.
Mahecic notes Ethiopia also has a huge problem with internal displacement. As part of the overall interagency humanitarian effort, he says the UNHCR and partners will assist more than 1.5 million Ethiopians who have been forced to flee their homes because of conflicts and climate shocks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
ID for Africa is an NGO movement that accompanies African countries on their journeys to develop robust and responsible identity ecosystems in the service of development and humanitarian action. It was established in 2014. Officials say the organization continues to make significant impact on the direction of identity matters across Africa. The organization will be hosting its sixth annual meeting of the ID for Africa movement, also known as ID for Africa 2020, from June 2 to 4 in Marrakesh, Morocco. For more about the organization and the upcoming conference, I reached Dr. Joseph Atik, Executive Chairman of ID for Africa.
ID for Africa is a non-governmental organization. It is a movement. It represents the identity stakeholders from 48 African countries that have taken the effort to nominate ambassadors that represent them to the movement. And what the movement does is promote the development and deployment of responsible digital identity systems for social and economic development. About 6 years ago, when it became clear that identity was an important pillar in development. The movement was founded to help accompany the African government on their journey to adopt this new systems and framework, to put together the legal framework necessary to work with the stakeholders and to put together the policy necessary to benefit from the fruits of development.
There is an upcoming summit being organized by ID for Africa in Morocco. What do you seek to achieve with this upcoming summit?
ID for Africa holds an annual meeting every year about the end of May or June. And that meeting is essentially a time for the entire stakeholders to come together. More than 1,500 people, government officials from Africa, development agency representatives, the private sector, the civil society, they all come united with one purpose in mind, which is to do an assessment of where we stand in terms of the progress that we've made in terms of digital identity systems, but also to share knowledge, experiences, and learn what's the latest, see what's have been happening, what remains in terms of gaps, and how others have been able to fill them. This is a summit of South-South knowledge exchange, but also it is a place where the entire world comes to learn about the impact of identity for development. And this year it will be held June 2nd to 4th in Marrakech, Morocco.
What are the anticipated expectations for this get-together of this annual meeting?
So expectation number one is knowledge that's useful, actionable intelligence to take back home, say, we are going to accelerate the adoption. Because every year, the African countries continue to lack an identity system and their people continue to be invisible, means that they are missing participation in development and participation in economies, job creation. So the impact is very clear for countries that are left behind. And so their representatives come to learn about actionable things they can do in order to accelerate their entry into digital transformation, empowered by digital identity. So learn useful information on how to implement. And it's not just the technology. It could be policy. It could be a legal framework, data protection. It could be also how to reach out to the population to sensitize them and ensure outreach is successful.
A lot of meetings, symposiums are held. There are participation, but the implementation or impact on the ground is sometimes minimal. How is ID for Africa Summit different? And what do you think will be the takeaways for them to implement to the benefits of their own people?
In fact, ID for Africa is not just an event. The event is just the icing on the cake for us. It's an annual meeting for us to get together and to compare notes, et cetera. ID for Africa works all year long, starts with the fact that each country has the office of the ambassador. And for the bigger countries, that means the ambassador and the deputy ambassador. And they are in charge of putting together the coordination of, they are in charge of coordinating among the identity stakeholders of their country. And so on an ongoing basis, they meet through a framework we call the National Identity Steering Committee, the NIST, which is allowing them to basically say who's an identity provider, who's an identity user, and what services and applications can we build in order to make sure that we monetize the investment in identity. And we sometimes facilitate for them access to expertise, either internal. We sometimes facilitate to them access to financing and expertise, such as the World Bank, African Development Bank, or even from the industry and the private sector. And so this is, we live it, we breathe it, all year long.
Dr. Joseph Atik is the executive chairman of ID for Africa. He spoke with me from the French capital, Paris.
Yo, yo. Yes, she.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection, and you're hearing from Harmonize with Honey Stewie. Simi follows with Selensi, and then Pato Rankin featuring Busiswa with Open Fire, Jody Kuchi Kuchi with Old Baby, David Lutalo with Sweet, and then Sona Jobati ends it with Gambia.
Hey.
kesho nimekosa kazi ya Mola haina makosa huyu kampa boda mwingine berosa vuta subira ngoja Mungu aje kutosa fitina nana sigeuze changamoto maneno mwachia mina nana dawa ya moto ni moto oh nana na. Wako wanasema konde atapotea konde atapotea yeah. Kati ya gia chombo hiyo inapepea chombo inakula kwa jasho nipatacho naridhika nasubiri kesho zamu yangu itafika nenda wambie za kujisifu najua kila kukicha kwa Mungu naomba dua haso nazidisha ili nizidi kusua wakinifunika kesho nitawafunua mchanga hauzikwi unaubadilisha makazi uwezi zibariziki mure utaki na kula kwa jasho nipatacho naridhika nasubiri kesho zamu yangu itafika nenda wambie
sina mali ila mimi nakutamani nikupeleke nyumbani lali lali.
was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Desta Wandira, and we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, however full the house, the hen finds a corner to lay in. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
VOA News, I'm Gene Randall.